This is Andrew, and this week, Wolf, I'm going to talk about weakness.
Weakness.
Yes. Now, weakness in this case is not either a flaw or a vulnerability, but is in fact what you would consider to be weak pointers, what most people refer to as weak pointers.
Oh, I thought you were just going to talk about chocolate. Okay.
Yeah. Well, that might be some weakness, but that's not... Well, in any case, I had a much longer joke about that, but I was, all right, screw it. Okay, so when you think of weak pointers, most people probably think, well, that's pretty simple, right? That's just a pointer that turns to nil when the object is deallocated, and
well,
you're
they,
done.
They sound, you know, magical to me, because I'm used to raw pointers, but yeah, yeah.
Right, right. So there are actually two pieces to it when I think about how I would define what a weak reference is. The first thing is it's a reference without ownership. So it doesn't control the lifespan of the object that it points to.
Mm-hmm.
And again, that's the way that it used to be for everything. Everything was an unsafe pointer back in the old days. So the retained releases were conceptually unrelated to the pointers. You made that association in your own mind and in your own code, but they were not set up to do that automatically. And the second part is a system of bookkeeping, which matches those object lifespans with pointer state.
Mm-hmm.
And I, when I was thinking about how I would describe this, I was thinking of this in terms of the last gasp of garbage collection.
Yeah.
Because when you describe weak references like that, the weak references that we use today in our code, it's exactly the way they worked under GC. So ARC is conceptually exactly like manual retained release. Now, the implementation might be a little different. I know they've done some things with it to make it a little different. But conceptually, it's basically exactly what you got under manual retained release. It's just that they add in the retained releases. But they couldn't very well call it the future of Objective-C programming, of programming, and still have dangling pointers. So they needed to basically import weak references and the system that they used from GC back into ARC. And then import that again pretty much as is directly into Swift. The big difference is that while GC was asynchronous, in the sense that they took the time to sort of do all their bookkeeping on an entirely different thread, and at times that could not be predicted, ARC has to be completely synchronous in this case. Now, normally when you're just saying, well, am I going to deallocate this object or not, that's fine. That can go fairly quickly. But here you've got this whole extra system where all the resolution of the bookkeeping, all the toting up of the numbers, has to happen exactly when the retains and the releases are called. Because you can't otherwise have all these pointers going around, which would otherwise be dangling. So if you had a million weak references, for example, and then that last dealloc came through for your object, all of those weak references would have to be nilled out right then. And so I don't know the exact performance characteristics of this. I didn't try it beforehand. I don't know if it would take a million objects to slow this down, or if they're that fast, it would take, you know, 5 million or a billion. Probably not a billion. But it is better than memory leaks, right? You don't want your objects to stick around forever. And so you do it. And it's also better than memory leaks, also in the sense of the strong reference cycles that we have now. Now, again, garbage collection kind of solved that problem for us in that you could have two pointers pointing to each other, and they would still both go away if nothing else pointed to them. But we don't have that anymore. Now, another thing I wanted to talk about was that there's no hooks into this behavior, at least not that I know of. Wolf, you may have heard something. There might be something at the very low level of the system, but I don't think there is anything that I've ever seen.
I think the closest thing I know is where you can basically hook the OBSI IVAR stuff, the low level C API, to the Objective-C runtime, and basically you can add at runtime, you know, we have the basically kind of like the dynamic IVARs type stuff now. You can add something to it. And so when you can basically use it as a hook to be notified when an object is going away.
Okay, that's when an object is going away, but that's not when the reference gets nilled out.
Right. But I think Reactive Cocoa tries to use that as a way of type of tracking that type of stuff. But I think that's actually too late. They have to actually swizzle Dalek to do that. But anyway, I'm derailing you. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Well, what's interesting is there are some container classes that I've used that allow you to have weak pointers to things. So NS Dictionary, NS Set, NS Array will not let you do that. If you have a pointer, if you have a reference to something inside one of those containers, it has a strong reference to it. Mm. But you can use NS Map Table instead of the dictionary,
right.
And NS Hash Table instead of a set. And you can set those up. They're more general purpose. They've got more options. So you can say, well, no, make the references weak. And they will not hold on to an object. So an object can go away. Well, it's referenced by one of these things, and its reference to it will be known out. Now, I can't remember where I saw this particular piece of information, but I'm pretty sure of it, that I read somewhere that while these containers will let the object go, and if you then ask for the object from them, they'll say, no, we don't have it. In fact, they've got some bookkeeping of their own, which says, you know, hey, here's this key, this value, here's this value for the sake of the NS hash table. And that bookkeeping doesn't go away. It's just that the reference inside of it, the pointer inside of it, does go nil. And the reason for that is because, again, there are no hooks that it can rely on. It can't get told. So instead it has to kind of do, I don't know, like polling or just, what do you call it? It just occasionally say, well, when I'm called for something, clean up after myself. That's what I assume. Anyway, I haven't actually seen the implementations of these things. So you'll have a little bit of extra data in all of those and potentially a lot of extra metadata if you get rid of a whole bunch of weak references all at once, because that's the only way that they can operate. Mm-hmm. I thought that was interesting. And I actually did implement, there was one, I think NS map table and NS hash table were not in iOS at first as ARC supported versions.
Right.
And so I actually made my own, which did what they do, which basically said, well, I have a weak pointer in there, but I won't get rid of the metadata. And it was funny to find out later that that's pretty much what they do anyway. Another thing that I want to get to is blocks. Now, blocks, as far as I understand it, were invented during the GC era. So, again, during that point, as I said before, strong reference cycles were not a problem. So blocks have the problem that it's very easy for them to retain the thing that owns what they're in.
Yeah, that's legendary, yeah.
And under GC, that wasn't a problem. And so under ARC, they had to introduce the weak strong dance.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that's a title. And most people have dealt with this. Well, I'll just go through it really quickly. So you have a weak reference to, say, self before the block starts, and you only refer to that weak self reference, which I recently saw that called wealth.
I have not heard that. That's terrible.
Isn't that terrible?
Yeah.
And then inside of it, you assign that to a strong reference, the same thing. Mm-hmm. And again, I just call it strong self, mm-hmm. weak self, and strong self.
Mm-hmm. It's very Homestar Runner.
Yes, but strelf or swelf, I've seen that as well.
No, you know, you're just making this up now.
No, the real world code, I've seen this. And then you assign it to a strong reference. If it's non-nil, then you just use it from where you are. And excuse me, that's so that in the middle of all your block code, it will not get sent to nil right in the middle of it. Mm-hmm. And that actually reminds me of the swap stuff that we talked about last time around.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's you have 10 steps and you don't want something to happen in the middle of it. An exception, whatever. I really wish that they had been able to do this better, especially in Swift. Because Swift still has this problem, even in blocks. Now, Swift does have, I'll put a link in the show notes to the Apple documentation about this. They talk about capture lists. So a capture list is their way of letting you make a weak version of this pointer in kind of a more formalized way. But it's still an extra step to do that. And you still have to assign it to a strong pointer inside to go through that dance. The dance still exists. Dances with Welves.
Oh.
Anyway, yes.
That was premeditated. Come on.
Okay. So now, the Clang will tell you, let me warn you, I think it's a standard warning at this point, if you have this strong reference inside of a block to self or possibly to other things, it will tell you, hey, don't do that. But what it won't do by default, at least I don't think, is if you do only half of the weak strong dance. So if you make it a weak pointer and then you use the weak pointer throughout your blog, then that's also a problem and you shouldn't do it. Although I've seen people do it. I don't know where it's the strong weak thing is it's a pain. So maybe some people don't want to do it. But if you have multiple uses of weak, you shouldn't do that. And there is actually a crying warning that I just learned about this week, repeatedly using a weak reference. Wolf, did you know about this?
I believe I did.
Yeah. So you can turn that on, and then that will tell you about that. And I really like that as a concept. Now, there's also a sending messages to weak pointers at all, which I also like.
Oh, you know, I think I was confusing the latter with the former.
Yeah.
Oh,
okay.
Okay, yeah.
Now, since I just found out about this, I took my home project, and I turned it on. And I said, hey, this will tell me about all the blocks where I still have this problem. Well, no. What it did instead was give me hundreds of warnings about all the uses of my weak properties, of the things that I was doing that were back pointers to something else. And it's interesting because when I got to think about it, Swift does, in their documentation, they do talk about the difference between weak pointers and unowned pointers. And an unowned pointer, as far as they're concerned, is something where you know the lifespan of it, you know it's not going to become nil. So you don't have to worry about that bookkeeping that I was talking about before. Mm-hmm. But you also don't want it to own anything. You don't want it to be a strong reference. So you say unowned. The trouble is unowned pointers are, by definition, dangling pointers. Because they don't do the bookkeeping, you can't be sure that they won't, at some point in your lifecycle, have a mismatch with the other object and refer to it and blow up. So I was thinking about it, and you know what I really want is something, you know, I want something better. I think I probably want conditional weak pointers. Because what I want is to say, well, as long as this other thing exists, don't worry about this weak pointer. It's not going to go away. And so I don't have to worry about all of these crazy, use. I don't have to do the strong weak dance for every use of every back pointer I ever have in my classes. But I do want it to go away once that other thing goes away. And then, you know, then we'll know that we're good. And in that case, I still probably wouldn't do the weak strong dance because I'd know everything fails. In that case, I know that I'm to the point where I never want to use it anymore. So it's funny, you know, we've got sort of halfway there in so many ways, but we're not there as far as I'm concerned. I would want to turn on these references, but I still want my back pointers to be weak and not unowned. And I can't do that with these warnings. So that's where I'm at as far as weakness is concerned, at least this week.
Okay.
So, wow, I didn't even plan that. Woo, yeah, me.
Well, way to flame out there,
thoughts?
Man.
Yes.
Yeah. While you're talking, I want to basically fix what I said before, where I was talking about like dynamic properties or something like that. That's not. I was thinking of associated objects. And that's basically...
Oh, don't think of associated objects.
Well, that's basically the hack you can use to get a notification for when things go away. Basically, you have a custom class that all it does is that it handles dialloc, and it knows to message you when a pointer is going... when the object you're pointing at goes away.
Oh, that's awful.
And so, yes. And so you can be notified when something you're looking at will go away.
Yep.
Yeah.
But it's still... You can't be sure what order the dialogs are going to come in at. Yeah,
that's exactly part of the problem. Dialog is a harsh environment, yeah.
Yep.
Okay. So on to my topic, which is evil maids and security by epoxy.
What the hell?
That's what I was going for. So I can't believe I already lost my tab here. Sorry about that. Oh, yeah. So at...
You've lost something on it.
At the C1, C3 conference on December 29th of last year, there was this great talk by Trammell Hudson. There we go. And he introduced an exploit that has been making the news rounds called Thunderstrike. And
I saw that in your notes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So Thunderstrike is essentially so all modern Macs nowadays have Thunderbolt ports on them, and it turns out that one of these things that uh, uh, one of the interesting things about Thunderbolt is that essentially it's a PCI extended in a serial cable, and that has good things and has bad things. And the kind of the things that fall out of that is that there's this old, going back to the like the ISA, the industry standard architecture PC cards of like 1980s, like early 1980s, there was this idea of option ROMs, and it's the idea that when your computer's turning on, it would just you have an extension card in there, and maybe that card needs to run some code on the Intel processor to actually set up an environment or do some bus traffic or something like that. So what would happen is that it would just go down the line, and it would ask the card, hey, do you have an option ROM? If so, I'll read that code, and then I'll execute it for you. And it turns out that because this idea of option ROM has been taken forward, and it used to be ROM, read-only memory. Then it was like EEPROM, erasable programmable ROM, which you could use like a UV light to flip the bits to zero and then reprogram it or something. But nowadays, they're even flashable. So they're not really ROMs that are, they're not really option ROMs that are anymore. They're more like option flashes. And so it turns out that a bunch of Thunderbolt devices actually have flashable option ROMs. And so one of those is Apple's gigabit to Ethernet adapter. And so what Trammell did is he created an exploit that will put executable code inside the option ROM of a gigabit Ethernet adapter. And and when their computer turns on, it will then that code will execute, and actually will be able to load that code into a persistent location inside your Mac. So what's really cool is that horrifying. I don't know why I couldn't say that all of a sudden, but there you go. I reserve the right to edit that out. Yes. Now leave it in. And so essentially, it's a firmware rootkit or a boot kit.
Yeah.
And the interesting thing about this is that it's potentially viral. That you could actually that an infected Mac with ThunderStrike could actually then write the exploit code into other writable Thunderbolt devices. Be them as large as Raider disk arrays, as small as gigabit Ethernet adapters, and then you plug in the next Mac and can spread. So that's don't copy that floppy type of new wave thing. But extra cool is that the way it works with the EFI system is that once your Mac is flashed, it can make it so that you cannot remove ThunderStrike, so that it's a one-way ticket, baby. So there's a couple articles that was linked for it about this. The higher level one, if you're not too interested in the technical details, is from Tidbits, and I'll link to it. Ars Technica had one that had more details on there, and link to that. So Trammell's ThunderStrike was based on a previous attack called written by Snare, and I forget actually what he called it, but it was presented at Black Hack 2012. And it's basically used the same type of stuff that his just kind of builds on it with the option ROM stuff. But a lot of these type, what makes this all fundamentally possible is DMA attacks. And this is a well-known kind of attack surface. So, and all of what I'm about to talk about kind of boil down to what's known as evil made scenarios. The idea you are at a conference or on vacation or whatever, and you leave your notebook in the hotel room. And if if someone steals it, that's pretty obvious. All your laptop's been stolen. But much more nefarious is the idea that someone actually has access to your computer without you being around, and what type of attacks can they do? And the idea here is that the maid that comes to flip the bed, clean your room, that has unbridled access to the computer, and what can that person do to your computer once they have physical access to your computer?
Right, without needing to log in or anything.
Right. Well, so there's really, so thanks to the wonderful binary of power on and power off, so there's two possible states there. So the first state, let's assume that your computer's sleeping and therefore, you know, mostly on. So there are these things called DMA attacks. And DMA stands for direct memory access. It is back in the old days, in order to, say, copy bytes from your floppy disk into RAM, your CPU would tell the floppy drive to move a byte, and then the floppy drive would proceed to interrupt it when every single byte came in, and maybe when a line of data came or something like that. But it was really inefficient in that basically the CPU was being constantly interrupted, thus to shuttle bytes around, and it wasn't very good use of transistors. So direct memory access allows you to do things where the memory controller sees both RAM and the bus and can do things like when you copy one hard drive to the next, you instruct the memory controller to copy a block, the physical address of starting at this address to with this length, and usually it's in list form, and you can instruct the memory controller to do that for you, and then let me know when it's done. And so it allows devices to copy data amongst themselves without the processor being directly involved all the time. And this is a huge win for efficiency. And it's also great for attacks. So you see so this was part of PCI and PCI Express. And since Thunderbolt essentially is PCI Express over serial cables, that means that it also applies to Thunderbolt. I was surprised that PCMCIA, which stands for People Can Memorize Computer Industry Acronyms, and PC Card Express Card, PCMCIA was old enough that I thought it wouldn't be affected by this, but apparently it is. So all those are susceptible to DMA attacks and FireWire. And so this is actually in 2002 is when I first heard about this. I knew that FireWire had DMA access, and I thought that was pretty cool, unlike USB. And so Quinn the Eskimo at Mac Hack. I thought you were there, so you remember this. Okay, yes. So Quinn the Eskimo at Mac Hack 2002 showed off his hack Firestarter, which he won best hack for.
He did win. Okay, yeah.
Yes. And I'll link to a Tidbits article, Adam Inks. I think we shared a room that year even. But I think he wrote up
TMI.
What would Tanya say? The hack was very cool. Essentially, Quinn booted the victim Mac, the target Mac, off CD-ROM of the System 7 installer, whatever, System 9, wherever you're on, Mac OS 9 back then, and probably Mac OS 8. I got them all wrong except for that one. And then he had plugged in the attack Mac, which via FireWire, and he leveraged the ability to basically read and write the Mac's memory via direct memory access over FireWire. And he was able then to find video memory, and then he was able to draw on the screen of this immutable computer fire along the bottom to show he had flames, complete ownership. Yes. And that is so Mac hack, right? That's a totally Winnie hack thing. It's one thing to say, oh, look, and you see this all the time. We're like, look, I'm showing you this Linux terminal prompt of shows I have ownership of this machine. No, you got to do style, man. You got to set things on fire.
Yep.
So that was, I love that proof of concept. And I even predicted when I saw that that epoxying FireWire ports would become a thing as a way to deal with this wide open exploit. So essentially, if you had a physical access to a Mac, you could plug an attack Mac into it and instantly own it. Even if you did things like FileVault in modern days, that where you think your Mac is all encrypted, no, it turns out that key is unencrypted in memory. And since you can direct memory access it, that means you can pull that key right out of memory, and then you can encrypt the entire hard drive. So there's in terms of defenses against DMA attacks, Joanna Rutkowska wrote on the Invisible Things blog that she talked to a TrueCrypt developer, maybe the TrueCrypt developer. I don't know. That's kind of shady. It's not many, I don't think most people know. And I think it's kind of important to set the stage for what the real deal here is. And I'll quote from her article, and this is actually from a quote from the TrueCrypt developer, which she talked to, that we generally disregard janitor attacks since they inherently make the machine untrusted. We never consider the feasibility of hardware attacks. We simply have to assume the worst. After an attacker has worked with your hardware, you have to stop using it for sensitive data. It is impossible for TPM, Trusted Platform Module, to prevent hardware attacks, for example, by using hardware keyloggers, which are readily available to average Joe users, computer shops, etc. So that's an important thing, that when someone has physical access to your computer, you have a lot of problems. And I will go through some of these, but most systems rightfully do not defend against physical access. It's infeasible. So let's continue with that in mind. So there are still mitigations, but they are not 100% effective, but they can help. So it turns out that Apple ended up doing, they disable FireWire DMA when you lock the screen on OS X. And now the question is, like, I heard this a while back. I was like, oh, that's a great workaround. But then when I thought about it, like, it doesn't totally make sense to me. I don't know exactly how it works, because when you think about it, you know, what if you're booted off a FireWire hard drive? Obviously, you just can't turn off FireWire DMA because you're using that to rushy run your computer. So there's not this, like, wholesale cutting off FireWire at the knees there when you go to the lock screen. Maybe they're disabling it for devices you plug in after you go to lock screen. That would be pretty smart, intelligent. I don't know if they can even do that in the first place. A lot of this is very hardware-y, firmware-y type stuff. It's nice that Apple owns the entire stack there, but I don't actually know all the details there, which... So if any listeners want to send us email or send me a tweet that tells me exactly how that works, that'd be great. And so I'm...
Send him a thumb drive
with the information. There we go. Send me a gigabit Ethernet adapter. I'll plug it right in.
Yeah.
I'm thinking that presumably they're not doing DMA disabling for Thunderbolt yet for screen lock. Maybe they will eventually. I looked through the slides, and for what Apple is considering doing for mitigating Thunderstrike, and I actually didn't see that, so I don't really know what the deal is there. I did mention that with File Vault, that the key is in memory, and you can do things to get your keys out of memory. Number one, you should know what you should use, understand what File Vault actually buys you, and you should use it, and you should also understand its limitations. Thomas Tocek wrote a great article about the really harsh environment that full disk encryption has to run under, and which I'll link to. I recommend you read it so you understand that it's kind of a security of last resort, and it's comparatively weak to say file encryption. You kind of look at full disk encryption and you think, oh, it's going to be super secure. And it turns out the encryption has to be weak in comparison to this file encryption. But anyway, link to that, go read it. I recommend it. You can do things where you store the full disk encryption keys not in memory. So you can, one hack is that you can actually use the SSE registers where you can store the keys in that. And then it turns out SSE is a processor feature that you can disable. And so some security enhanced Linux option will actually disable SSE. So you can't use that. Your program will crash if it tries to use it, and it will store your encryption keys in there. So that way when you try to DMA the keys out of memory, they're not there in the first place. So those SSE registers are not accessible via DMA. Intel's management engine apparently also has some sort of like secure enclave-like support. Intel's management engine is probably a show just in its own right, but I will point to some slides that provide a bunch of information about Intel's management engine. It is quite powerful, and it's a force for good and evil. And so that's a live system. That's you had your sleeping Mac in the hotel room, and the nefarious person has opened up the lid and now can DMA.
Hopefully you're a couple of floors up so you can just pitch the laptop out the window.
There you go. So you might say, well, okay, so DMA is a weak spot here. What I'll do is I'll power down my Mac before I leave. And that, unfortunately, is also problematic.
Really?
Yes.
Damn it.
Yes. It turns out that this is actually in the same article, Rutkowska's, that I referenced the True Crypt developer quote, Joanna introduced the Evil Made USB, which is basically a thumb drive type thing where you just... The entire idea is that you boot off a USB thumb drive, and you can do things. And you know, hard drives are mutable, so you can install things that you know they need to have an unencrypted boot block. And the idea is that you can install a little bit of code in there. Her attack specifically was against TrueCrypt, so that it basically got in front of TrueCrypt and was able to log your TrueCrypt password. And TrueCrypt in that is basically full disk encryption for Windows-ish computers. There is some mitigation there that EFI, you can set an EFI firmware password to disallow boot target selection so that it will always boot off the internal drive. This is still fairly weak because this can pop the case and physically attach your drive. It's actually, now that I think about it, on the MacBook Airs and stuff like that, you know, now that everything is just freaking soldered to the motherboard, that's actually helps a lot. But, you know, and if you're going up against an adversary that is doing this well, I'm sure they can put some jumpers on there and access both simultaneously. An interesting thing that's, I think it's so cool, is that if you don't want to do kind of get in front of the bootloader type thing, is that RAM's data is recoverable after shutdown. So there's this class of attack called the cold boot attack. And the idea is that you just pull the plug on a running system. And it turns out that we have this fantasy that RAM is 1 and 0, and when you pull the plug, it goes to 0. And it turns out dynamic RAM actually kind of sputters on a little bit, even after not being refreshed. And it turns out, and where the name of this attack comes from, is that you can extend the lifetime of how much of the data being kept in RAM by cooling the RAM chips. So you can do this with a compressed air can and spray the chips directly, or you can just take a cell phone and throw it in a freezer, and that will extend the lifetime of these dead RAM chips in terms of how much memory they retain. There's even a tool that I'll link to called FROST, which of course is an acronym for initialism I learned recently via the wonderful power of Twitter, the Forensic Recovery of Scrambled Telephones. And FROST is essentially, apparently Android has encrypted flash storage nowadays, and this defeats it. The idea is that you take a cell phone that's power, obviously running, powered on, throw it in the freezer, make it nice and chilly, reboot it off a USB drive, and all the USB drive is a small program, and you want the small because you want to minimize the amount of RAM you're overriding here. That the it just dumps the contents of memory from address 0 to the end out the USB port and for capture, and then you can analyze it offline. There's also a great article about live RAM forensics that I also linked to. The site was a little bit flaky. I had to grab the Google cache of it right before the show notes. Hopefully it's live late when we're actually writing up. If not, I'll throw like archive.org link in there or something. And there is a defense against this again. There's all sorts of mitigations. It's very spy versus spy. Memory scrambling. So this is something, it's instead of storing RAM for, you know, straightforwardly, like you'd think, is that the memory controllers can actually scramble the memory. So if you get physical access to it, that you're not actually getting the byte identical bits that what you get in the plain text. This again is a hostile environment to good encryption, much like full disk encryption. So it's pseudo random. It's not great, but it's something. And apparently Xbox uses it, and apparently also some Intel Core processors even support this. So I'll throw a link to that. And of course, then you have boot kits like ThunderStrike, where you just can plug in a gigabit Ethernet adapter and own the machine. Even, you know, power it on. You've owned the machine. Unplug it. Put the machine back, just back, power down again, and the user never knows that you've owned their machine. Of course, keyloggers are a favorite. These usually are in terms of USB dongles that connect in between the USB keyboard and the Mac. They can be quite small, and you can pop them on the back of a computer, and a lot of people will notice them. You can even make it so that you don't need physical hardware whatsoever. In DEF CON 2009, Kay Chen had his Apple keyboard firmware-based logger. It turns out that the Apple keyboards on desktop Macs, that actually they run a firmware that can be flashed, and so you can upgrade your keyboard software. And so he figured out how that all worked, and he made it so you can install a keylogger with zero hardware, just using the hardware that Apple provides. And this happened in 2009, and I seem to remember there was, like, Apple protected against this, maybe, but it might still be live. I don't know. Probably isn't. But so I just wanted to scare you with that potential. So the take-home point on all this is that it's very hard to defend against physical access. If you want to defend against, right now, your defense against ThunderStrike is either to have the very latest Mac Mini or iMac Retina, which apparently already has some mitigations built into it. And Apple apparently will be doing a software update that rolls out more defenses for older machines. But you can just start epoxying your ports closed. You can epoxy your case on your computer so that it can't be opened. You can just encase the entire thing in Ember, right? And that's, you know, it goes through the entire security thing where the only secure computer is in a vault, unplugged with the lights off type stuff, right? But practically, if you really care about this stuff, the simple solution is, since physical access is so detrimental to overall security, is buy a tamper-evident lockable case and store your computer in there. Because, man, all these attacks are very effective and really hard to defend against, and it's hard to know when you've even been attacked. So if you just put it in a case that people can't get physically into very easily, that really solves the problem in a much more low-tech way. So I recommended that.
Do you have such a case?
Oh, I want one now. Now that I've actually run out this outline.
Well, and of course, the other takeaway point is never let them clean your room.
There we go. Yes. Keep a messy room.
Yeah. So, oh my God. It's really kind of abandon hope.
Yeah, yeah.
So it actually reminds me of another thing from C4, I think, where you had those two security guys come in.
Yeah, yeah.
Where they were basically trying to, say, don't think you can learn enough to defend yourself.
Yeah,
because you really can. It's really much worse than you. So don't think there's anything you can do to harden your laptop or your desktop against it. Just move away to that cabin in the woods.
Sounds good to me.
And we'll see you next time.